With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. On this week's episode, in the red corner, we have treasure, pirate ships, puzzles, and the now infamous Truffle Shuffle, plus a whole host of teenage wish fulfillment as Sean Astin, Corey Feldman, and Josh Brolin get together for one of the defining movies of the 80s, from a story by Steven Spielberg and with Richard Donner directing. Hey, you guys! It's 1985's The Goonies.
Meet Mikey.
I gotta go to the bathroom.
Brand. Andy.
Shame, shame.
Come on, Brand.
Slip with the tongue.
That's disgusting. No, I can't even look.
Mouth.
I gotcha. Now get out from behind her. You're ruining the painting.
You're ruining my job.
Stephanie. Data.
Boy, Bando.
Ow.
Guys, isn't that neat?
And Chunk.
Flop.
They call themselves the Goonies. They've stumbled onto a legend, but they're not alone.
While in the blue corner, yes, more kids in the 80s, but this lot have got a lot more on their hands than some bumbling crooks as they take on Universal's very own monsters as Dracula, the Mummy, Frankenstein and more manage to avoid copyright infringement as they descend on small town America. And we finally answer the question that has plagued humanity for generations. Yes, Wolfman's got nards. From 1987, it's the Monster Squad.
You know who to call when you have ghosts. But who do you call when you have monsters?
We're the Monster Squad.
What's a squad? It's like Miami Vice, I think.
They're young and inexperienced.
Naughty virgin!
They're a bit disorganized.
Monsters are not real.
We don't know that, sir.
2,000-year-old dead guys do not get up and walk away by themselves.
But when strange things start happening in town...
There's a monster in my closet.
Ooh! Look at that big, scary monster!
What's happening?
You wait till the werewolf.
Silver bullet?
They're the only ones ready to do battle.
So, what connects these two movies, and which one does it better? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clash Podders. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
And I'm Chris Tilley.
Welcome to the show, Victoria, Chris. Damn, watching these movies has made me miss your faces. How are you?
I've just got to deal with a child. Bear with.
Oh, all right. Cool. Chris, how are you? Any children?
No, but I agree with you, Alex. You guys are the closest I've got to a gang these days. And so...
Right?
Yeah. And it made me sad. It made me want my childhood back as well, which is something that Vicky's clearly dealing with on her side right now. Oh. Why don't we talk about the guesses, Alex?
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah. So, thanks, Chris. We do have some guesses from our lovely at ClashPod Twitter feed. That is at ClashPod. If you don't follow us already, please join the party. And it is a social media party. So the clue that went up on Twitter, and indeed I announced last week, was the kids aren't all right. Granted, it was a fairly vague clue. Big news, no one got it. But our surreptitious way of getting suggestions for future Clash Pods remains strong. So Russell and Andrew Logan went with The Omen versus The Exorcist, which I definitely think is a potential Clash of the Future, Chris.
100%. Yeah. Oh, and I like that phrase, Clash of the Future. That's very good.
Blackheart went for Kindergarten Cop and the Pacifier. Vin Diesel versus Arnie, rather. That's not bad. I could do that.
Yep. I noticed our Kindergarten Cop's just been added to Netflix, so I wouldn't mind revisiting that one.
Johnny Moore says Orphan and Brightburn. I like this as a suggestion. Thoughts?
Yeah.
No, okay. Whereas Anthony M. Rose went for It Chapter One versus Stand By Me, a couple of Stephen King adaptations. Although, if we're doing It, we are doing the Tim Curry version. And that covers this week's obligatory Tim Curry mention. Got it in early this week. But the closest this week, big respect to Paul Jordan, who got it after the very first clue. He went with The Goonies versus Breakfast Club. So he's our half winner of the week. Congratulations, Paul Jordan. Goonies versus Monster Squad. So, Victoria, have you returned from child management?
Yeah, I'm here.
Excellent. Is it all good? All good in the hood?
I can't tell you what they're up to. It's bonkers out there. I don't want anything to do with it. So I'm happier here.
Shut the door and pretend it isn't happening. That's excellent.
It's just, I need to put a lock on the door, you know. Not really. I need to do this in the bathroom, but then that would sound weird. I don't know.
Have you not got a quiet space? You know, like the, is it an uncle that they stay with in the Famous Five? And the Famous Five were never allowed to go in his study. And it was always like, oh, I wonder what's in the study. Do you not have a Famous Five-style study the kids can't get to?
I've got a very damp room under the stairs that I could hide in if I was happy to share it with the mice, which is what it might come to.
Got to get Harry Potter out of there first, though.
right then. So, would you like to guess the connection between the Goonies and the Monster Squad? Victoria.
Bats on strings.
It's good, but it's not right. Chris.
Fat shaming.
Yeah, I had that. Fat shaming. Big kids love chocolate.
It's good or not, but it's not right. Victoria, any others?
No, actually, that's all I did.
I was very excited to see something that I'd not spotted before because I'd not watched the films back to back. Mary Ellen Trainer.
That is the connection, Chris. Yes, Mary Ellen Trainer. I've been dying to do the two films in which Mary Ellen Trainer plays the mother of our protagonist, Mrs. Walsh in The Goonies and Helen in The Monster Squad. I think her name's Helen. So, yes, the connection this week is the films of Mary Ellen Trainer.
And do you know that means that she actually overtakes Christopher Eccleston from last week as our most most appearances on Clash Pod films?
The real connection is this, obviously. The Mary Ellen Trainer thing was something I too spotted this time. I would not have known that in advance. The connection is not all gangs of youths are bad news.
What?
As in, gangs of youths are normally associated with bad things these days. But in the halcyon days of the 1980s, gangs of youths formed amazing clubs, like with catchphrases like Goonies never say die. I mean, just in your own head, just say it's Mary Ellen Trainer. You love that one. So, Victoria.
Yes.
I gave you the Goonies. Chris, I gave you the Monster Squad. We do it chronologically. The Monster Squad will be along on Thursday, which means today, Victoria, we're heading back to 1985. Take us through the Goonies.
Mm-mm-mm. Richard Donner directed Superman and Chris Columbus wrote Gremlins, something neither of them want you to forget, even when you're watching the Goonies. Possibly to disguise the fact that this much-loved mashup of pirate adventure, coming-of-age story, race-against-time monster and mob movie has, as its inciting incident, the dullest of setups. Where are the bad guys going to put their new golf course? Right on top of the goon docks, unless pals Mikey, Chunk, Data, Mouth, Brand, and some girls who turn up can find the mythical loot of notorious pirate hoarder One-Eyed Willie and buy their house back or something? Pursued by Italian mobsters who enjoy the opera because Italy, as well as chaining up their brother Sloth because the 80s, the plucky youngsters race to find the treasure before sunrise, eventually stumbling upon a really cool pirate ship, stuffing the most fake-looking gems you've ever seen into a hanky and saving the town. The end.
I mean, I would say that's more entertaining than the film, what you just did.
Thanks, Chris.
That was really good.
You seem to be pretty sure of yourself.
The foreclosure is a definite.
What's your dad going to do with all that stuff that's in the attic?
He's going to give it back to the museum.
Maybe there's some stuff up there for us. Maybe there's some stuff that we can keep from the outsiders.
Lots of
maybe there's some rich stuff.
No, rich stuff.
Look, 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 that says 1632. Is that a year or something? Wow, you guys realize what we could do? Ye intruders beware. Crushing death and grief. Soaked with blood of the trespassing thief.
Look at this. You see what I found?
There was a lot of villainous property development in the 80s, wasn't there? I don't think it's just the Goonies.
But I just property... think, could it not be not golf? I don't, or is it just...
Well, that was a great journey through the Goonies. I enjoyed it. I'm sensing that perhaps already this isn't the cult favourite that I've waded into this podcast believing it to be, Victoria.
No, it's not that. It's just never been as beloved by me as it has by other people I know. And I don't know why. I've seen it like two or three times. So I haven't seen it loads, actually. So two or three times. And then on this watching, of course I enjoyed it. But for the first time, I found the tone really hard to place and it annoyed me a little bit. And that's because I'm the oldest now. We'll go into this in a bit, but it falls between, which at the time it was much admired for, but it falls between film for adults and film for kids in a way that's weird, I think.
Okay, so let's establish. When you say it was never beloved, when you watched it the first time, what's your history with this film?
I just saw it when I was younger. I've no idea when, but it wasn't in the playground. I mean, I'm a little bit, not to show off, I'm a little bit too young for it to have been the thing when I was growing up. So it was always quoted by older kids, and then I watched it, and then I was like, oh, I get it, but I just didn't love it that much. I can't explain it.
Are you on the same page, Chris? Because you just said that introduction from Victoria was more entertaining than the movie.
No, that was no slight on the movie. That was just me paying Vicky a compliment on how good her
intro was. A huge compliment.
Have you thought about audiobooks, Victoria? In the fucking Harry Potter walks into fucking Hogwarts and fucking this. Fucking Dumbledore's there.
I am so offended.
I'm just returning us to parity after the compliment Chris gave you. There we are. Back to normal.
Yeah, my brother actually had to turn the podcast off in the car the other day because Vicky was swearing so much and his little child got upset.
Oh, are you being serious?
Yeah.
I had a mini tour for us booked to primary schools when lockdown's up, but that's been cancelled.
Oh, I'm mortified. I'm covering my mouth, which is unprofessional because I'm so mortified.
My first screening of this, I talked about on when our Remembering Cinema episode. So I won't go into it in detail, but Alex, have you been to any Fun in the Foyer screenings? Do people know what Fun in the Foyer screenings are?
It's not what I think it is.
Is this for adults or for kids, first of all?
It's the family screenings they put on a Sunday morning for children's films for critics.
Yes. Yes, yes. I've actually hosted a couple of those. And let me tell you, it's a lot more fun just going on stage and going, "Who likes dinosaurs?" I felt like a kid's entertainer. It was wonderful. So, yes, I am aware of these things.
Yeah, so I've only been to one as an adult because they're quite nightmarish if you're a critic trying to concentrate and there's millions of kids all around you. The only one I went to was Elf, and it kept my attention because the film was good, but I was quite hungover. They're Sunday mornings are bad news, and I was nearly sick on the child next to me. But that's another story. Because I went to my video shop so often when I was a kid, the guy that ran the video store gave my mum and dad tickets to a preview of The Goonies. And so I saw it before it came out in 1985. It was my first visit to Leicester Square to see a movie. And went with my folks, got given like Goonies pen, Goonies hat, whatever was in a goodie bag. And then afterwards, they asked kids to do little vox pops, little interviews to camera. And I went to do that. And I completely went to pieces when they asked me what I thought of the film and ran to my mum and dad. complete wet pants, which is ironic because 20 years later that literally became my job, was talking about films to camera. But as a 7-year-old, I could not cope with the pressure.
And what was your review of the film, though? What would it have been had you not cracked under the pressure of I don't know, a camera?
Well, I was conflicted because I enjoyed the film, but my mum and dad didn't. And if you remember, I said that at the beginning, when the cars drive by and Chunk smears his milkshake and pizza on the window, my mum just tutted really loudly and said, "American brats." And my dad kind of nodded in agreement. And so I was thinking, oh, am I not supposed to like these kids? So I was quite conflicted, but I liked it. I watched this a lot when I was a kid, and it was one of my favourites. And also, it was always on the telly. Once it hit TV, it was always seemed to be on. So I've seen it so many times, I barely needed to watch it again for this viewing. How about you, Alex?
I'm the opposite. I saw this once as a child, and I haven't watched it in what I'm going to guess about 30 years. So this is the second time I watched The Goonies in about 30 years. And I guess I'm a bit closer to Victoria. It never had the impact on me. Remember, you're a little bit older than us. So
oh, piss off, I'd Alex. Miss the... What am I, 1 year older than you?
I think it's more. I think it's a little bit more. but I kind of missed the... I missed the first wave. Like, it was like the kids were like, who saw it in the first wave, it must have been 12 years older than me. So I wasn't around for that. No, it's never been the cult favorite that it has for a lot of people. But I was very, very excited to watch it again, genuinely thrilled. And the opening of this movie is hands down the most excited I've been in about 2 or 3 years to watch a film, because I kind of knew what was coming, but I couldn't actually remember what it was. And the minute that score kicks in during the jailbreak, I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. And it never quite lived up to it.
I also know one other thing I've literally just remembered is that my mum went to the video store to try to rent The Goonies, and the guy, it hadn't come out yet, and the guy gave her a film called Ghoulies, which was a horror film rated 15.
Gremlins ripoff.
Yeah, Gremlins ripoff, yeah. Rated 15. Scarier than Gremlins, though, I would say. Mm. And gave it to my mum and said, oh, this will be fine. They swear a little bit, these creatures, but they'll be fine for the kids to watch. And that film really effed me up. That was a big that was a big mistake. So
I remember seeing the box of that, because the main ghoulie is this horrible green goblin creature popping out of a lavatory. It lives in a lavatory.
Yeah, it comes out of the toilet to bite someone. Yeah. For a future episode.
Right then. Yeah, or not. So let's go through the film. Victoria, would you like to guide us through the Goonies, or at least take us through any of the backstory, which I imagine you've uncovered regarding the creation of this classic, in some people's opinion?
I have a little bit for you. So it was made by Amblin Entertainment. And as you said, appropriately, therefore, Steven Spielberg is the person that comes up with the short story, the base of the story, and then gets Chris Columbus to flesh that out into a full screenplay. And then you've got Richard Donner on board to direct. But Steven Spielberg himself did also do a bit of directing, so some second unit stuff. But I think he also did a couple of quite well-known scenes, like the wishing well scene, which we'll come back to because I don't like that. And also the bit where they're banging on the pipes, which is quite funny. But if you think about what that might have been like for Richard Donner, for instance, if your producer is also a director and a very famous one and a very good one, then that might have been a bit of a difficult situation to manage. And I read a quote from Richard Donner to say how difficult that was, but particularly, obviously, you know, people say never work with kids or animals, and the kids may have been a bit of a handful. And what he said was, "I think the unique thing about working with the kids on this picture is that every night I'm contemplating suicide. Individually, they're wonderful, the warmest little things that have come into my life." And this is me speaking. That sounds sarcastic, but whatever. But in composite form, you get them together and it's mind-blowing, which means, I think, mind-blowingly awful. You can imagine. I mean, just imagine, like, a group of kids who know they're the centre of the grown-up's world. It would just have been... Or just, I don't know how anyone survived, to be honest.
I watched them. I don't know. Did you watch this? There was a thing on Zoom that Josh Gad hosted a reunion just in April this year to raise money because of the coronavirus. And he reunited the whole cast of the Goonies. It was quite incredible because you had on the video screen, there was like Josh Brolin was there, Spielberg was there, Richard Donner was there, Corey Feldman, Sean Astin, everyone was there. And Spielberg actually tells a story that I hadn't heard before about how towards the end of filming, Richard Donner had literally had enough. There were 2 weeks to go, and Richard Donner was just saying to Spielberg, I'm done. In 2 weeks, I'm going straight to my house in Hawaii and I'm going to relax and I cannot wait. And Spielberg flew the cast out to Hawaii before Richard Donner got there. And when Richard Donner arrived at his house in Hawaii and opened the door, the cast were there and went, ah!
That's a nightmare.
I mean, we'll be back next week on more practical jokes for millionaires. But B...
What a horrible thing to do to someone. That's awful. Awful thing to do. Oh, my God. Just looking forward to some peace and quite a bit of grown-up time.
Yeah, I can't remember which one of them said. They said he actually fell to his knees and went white. They thought he was having a stroke.
But then because they're kids, they're going to be like, oh, but you love us, really? Just annoying.
They're not normal kids either. Like, if you watch the behind-the-scenes footage, of which there's quite a lot of them shooting this film, they are quite bratty Hollywood kids, a few of them. I'd say particularly Jeff Cohen, who plays Chunk, and Corey Feldman, who plays Mouth. Like, they're very bratty, and I listened to the commentary from a few years back that's on the DVD when they all got together for the first time since, and they're still like that, you know, all talking over each other, and Corey Feldman just being the most annoying person on the planet. So,
you should watch the Zoom thing, Chris. It's on YouTube, and it's great because Josh Gad sort of goes, like, as he introduces each of them, he goes, "Hey, how have you been? It's great to have you here. What are you up to?" And every single one of them who isn't Steven Spielberg or Josh Brolin nearly just goes, "So I'm actually getting back into the film industry. I've got a new film coming out. This is my film." And you're like, "Come on, really? You're promoting on this?"
But I like the fact as well that Jeff Cohen, who's the only one that actually gave up acting after this, he seems like the most dramatic of all of them. He's got properly dressed up for it. He's got a little set. He acts out scenes.
Oh, you watched it. Did you see it as well?
I did. Yeah. I did. Anyway, enough of that. Vicky.
Yeah, it's worth watching, if only because it's full of technical nightmares as well. So it's enjoyable, but it's full of very awkward, hammy moments. Awkward moments and hammy moments, but you should watch it.
A bit like this podcast.
Makes us feel a lot better. And that's kind of it. If anyone's interested, it cost $19 million to make. It grossed $124. So that means that's a hit. But obviously, it's quite old. And so, yeah, it has since become a cult film. But, you know, I don't know. I think to some people, it isn't, basically. But let's have a look at why. So what I said before was I read a review from The Time that said that Spielberg had found an in-between niche. There used to be children's movies and adult movies, and now he's found the ground that's in between. So that's where I think we should start, because although it ties a lot of things together and it does them really well, so like Growing Up and Your First Kiss and Treasure and proper bad guys, and then the 80s corporate bad guys and pirates and all the rest of it, some of the stuff that's in the first 10 minutes to me is not for kids. Like, not in a sort of prudish, like, how dare they, but just, I don't see how they would get it. So, like, it opens with a pretend suicide. Who's that for? And then in about 10 minutes, there's a mention of heroin. And that, I'd forgotten that. Then that's a funny joke where Mouth is pretending to speak, he's speaking Spanish to a helper, a maid. I don't know what she is.
Rosalita, the housekeeper.
Rosalita, the housekeeper, and he isn't saying what the mother thinks he's saying. So he's talking to her about tidying up and saying, you want to keep all the drugs together. You put the heroin here, you do whatever. And I mean, heroin in a kid's film? No, that's like, no, that's, I don't think so. So I would be interested to, who do you think? Do you think this film was ever for kids, or is it for grown-ups? And there's nothing wrong with this, but who like roles tinting their own childhood? Like, there's nothing, no shade there, but is it actually for children? Like, would you let a child watch it?
Well, Richard Donner said he wanted to make a kids' film with a harder edge. And so he said that's why there's swear words and penises and obscene stuff with the housekeeper. And what he refers to as the truffle shuffle, he calls it the stomp with the belly. Which is a weird way to describe it. Well, I certainly remember my parents being a bit confused by all that stuff in the opening few scenes. Like, it did seem far too mature for me and my brother, who I guess were 6 and 7 at the time. And it is weird. It is weird. And there's the stuff with the sort of the sexual awakening almost of Mikey, and right at the end when she says, you know, whatever she says about your parts might not be ready now, but they will be, and it's like.
Yeah, does she mean his penis?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and on the commentary, the girl that delivers that line even says to Richard Donner, what were you talking about there? Is that as rude as I think it was?
It's difficult to answer that question. I loved it now a lot more because of those things, but then I'm a year-old adult, so I obviously, like, that appeals to me. I think they just went over my head as a kid. I don't think I was like, oh, heroin. I'll have to try and get that because they mentioned it in the Goonies.
And it definitely went over my head. I think what they were trying to do was do jokes for adults and children all in the same movie. And they didn't quite get the combination right, that mixture right, in the way that Pixar figured it out a few years later, how to do jokes for the mature audience and the young audience. And I think that's why Goonies, it's an odd one. And I think we've talked about this before about the 80s, just the tone of films was a bit strange and there was much more frightening stuff in children's films. And it just felt like all these young directors, the leash was let off them and they just did whatever the hell they wanted. And that's why you get these weird sort of juxtapositions in those films.
Which is exciting in the sense that it's like something that we would never see today.
Yep.
But you are right. It's about the tone. If you're walking into a movie and the whole start of the movie, the car chase and everything, it kind of, and the score especially, it sets up a very broad, like, warm kind of movie, apart from the attempted suicide, fake suicide, which I'd totally forgotten. You see, this is the thing. I saw that and just went, yeah, all right, cool. He's getting out of jail and that's how he's planned it. But obviously, now you've mentioned it, Victoria, it's a hanging scene. It's literally the first thing you see in the film. But you can't, the adult jokes don't land because by the time you hit that heroin stuff, you're already in the mindset that it's a kids movie. So you're more perplexed by it than ready for it and expecting it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the stuff where
they're also, they're not funny. The funniest stuff is the more ridiculous stuff. Like you mentioned the water pipes, the slapstick stuff like that, or the bit where Mouth puts his tongue through the oil painting. And Mikey goes, stop doing that. You're ruining my painting. And he goes, you're ruining my joke. It's great.
When he says the heroin line on the commentary, Corey Feldman says, don't you think it's a bit ironic that I'm talking about heroin here?
Irony's not the right word, though, is it? I don't know. It's a bit sad. It's dark. Grim. Upsetting. Yes, correct. Well, let's talk about the kids. But unusually, I'm going to start this by, I want to talk about Brand first, so Josh Brolin. I do too. Okay, good.
He's a good place to start.
Thanks. So first of all, he's obviously always been a good actor, and this proves it. And as a character, he brings that wish fulfillment that these films often have of having grown-ups listen to the kids as equals. So he represents the grown-up as Mikey's older brother. But I like the fact that he's got his own little, not necessarily an arc, but just little character stuff going on. So the fact that he's failed his driving test and he has to ride around on his sister's bike, his brother's tiny little bike. Oh no, he steals a bike from a child, doesn't he? A child's bike. And little things like that give him more presence and is a good counterpoint to the kids, because the kids obviously get on my nerves.
Yeah. I know this is going to sound weird because, you know, everyone, but to put it simply, Josh Brolin in this movie looks like he's been put through one of those apps that just de-ages you, like, as opposed to he looks exactly the same, just younger, which I know sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but like, obviously, oh, you mean 1985 Josh Brolin looks like Josh Brolin and the younger? Yeah, I do, but he just looks like him. But, like, he's just been airbrushed. He looks like a Photoshop version of Josh Brolin now.
Yeah, because he's got the same gravitas and, like, the same sort of heavyweight presence, but he's just wearing a white vest thing constantly and working out all the time. But he still could play the president easily.
He's also wearing his shorts outside his tracky bottoms, which I'm not sure about.
Is a look I love. I do know, I really do. You wouldn't think it with the hate of white socks, but I don't mind that look at all.
The little girl whose bike he steals and who stomps her feet in quite an adorable way, that's the actor who plays Data. That's his niece.
Okay, cool.
Wow.
A few more of those coming your way today.
Yeah. Bringing Tilly Trivia back. It's been a fallow few shows. I'm pleased to see Tilly Trivia is making a comeback in the most abstract way possible. Good. Brett Spiner? Oh, you mean Data from this movie. You don't mean Data from Star Trek.
Yeah, I would, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, I'm always thinking about Star Trek these days. Smashed through a couple of box sets of The Next Gen the other day. So, that's where my head's at. I was like, oh,
she doesn't look like Brent Spiner's niece, but fine.
Right. Cool. I don't even remember that moment. So, all right. Excellent. Good.
So the kids represent your standard tropes, your stereotypes. So you've got the clever kid. He's Asian. Discuss. You've got your fat kid who's humorous. Discuss. And you've got your sort of everyman, which is Mikey, and then the motor mouth called Mouth. Have I missed anyone? No, I don't think so. And then the girls that turn up later. So you've got Steph is an interesting character because she doesn't quite fit with a sort of fun best friend character, but Andy, the sort of main girl, if you will, is a very typical, like, I don't even know if she's a cheerleader, but the prize that everyone seeks. So Brand fancies her, wants to get off with her and all the rest of it. And she hasn't got much character accordingly.
Well, Jeff Cohen, who plays Chunk, apparently he actually auditioned for the role of Mouth. And in the audition, he was told by Donner, Spielberg et al, oh, you sound like a mouth, but you look like a chunk.
Jesus.
Oh, that's horrible.
So he got the role of Chunk anyway.
And then, So just to get back to the plot, I mean, I know that probably everybody knows this, but the engine of the story is we're trying to find the treasure of... Actually, I've just thought about this. If it's a kid's film, is it all right to have a character that's called One-Eyed Willy? Like, is that meant to be...
Oh my God, I never noticed that.
Yeah. I only just thought of it. Is that all right?
Ugh. Wait, was Willy... Was Willy a slang? A piece of slang? Was slang? Was it the slang? Slang.
It was.
Slang.
It was, because me and my brother thought that was the funniest thing we'd ever heard. That this.
Did you get it? Oh, I didn't get
Willy.
It.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just the fact that he was called Willy was funny to us.
Went over my head.
But it wasn't a really, in America, Willy wasn't the generic term. So it was more a little funny thing for English people. It wasn't an intentional joke, I don't think.
Okay, so the kids are off to find the treasure of One-Eyed Willy. One-Eyed Willy is a pirate from the past whose treasure has never been discovered, and they find a map in Mikey's dad's loft. He's got his own private loft, which is suspicious. And this treasure map will take them to the treasure. And Mikey really wants the treasure because he wants to save his house / the whole town, I wasn't clear, from some horrible golf developers. So there we're on our quest. The quest, which then puts us in the path of the Fratellis, who are a mum and three sons, crime bosses of some sort. And they're going to chase after the kids and provide a bit of real danger, as well as the danger of being in some ancient tunnels, solving puzzles, all the rest of it.
Yeah. So the bickering pair, Robert Darvey and Joe Pantoliano, I quite like their bickering. And apparently it's so authentic because they hated each other.
Really?
And that's, yeah, yeah. And Joe Pantoliano on this Zoom thing that Chris and I watched, this recent thing, this is like a month ago, was still sort of going when they were like, oh, Josh Gad sort of goes, oh, so, you know, you have this bickering thing. I mean, what was it really like that? And Joe Pantoliano goes, yep, I cannot stand the guy. And it's sort of like done in that kind of like, if I say it like this, it might sound like a joke, but read my face. I don't like the guy. But it sounds justified because in the audition, they auditioned together for the roles. And at the time, Joe was wearing a hairpiece. He'd already gone bald and he was wearing a hairpiece. And they walked in together and Robert Darvey like starts pointing out his hairpiece and going, you know, he wears a hairpiece. Look at his hairpiece. He's got a hairpiece on. You're going to cast him with a hairpiece? And like, it ended up with... I believe Robert Darvey nailing Joe Pantoliano's dressing room door shut on set. It was quite a fraught relationship.
What a fun set to be on, it sounds like, all in all.
Yeah, you thought the kids were going to be nightmares. Check out these two.
Setting a good example.
Michael Jackson was also a regular visitor to the set as well.
Was he?
Yeah.
Why?
Joey Pants says on the unofficial behind-the-scenes documentary, Joey Pants says, boy, oh boy, was that a mistake.
Oh, God. What's that mean? Oh, no.
Well, apparently loads of people visited the set because it was huge. They built the pirate ship for real so that the kids could be like, oh, my God, on this huge soundstage. And Harrison Ford visited the set. And apparently Clint Eastwood visited the set, watched for 15 minutes, and then went up to Richard Donner after watching like the kids for 15 minutes and went, do you ever think about going back to acting?
That's quite a good impression as well, actually.
Thanks. Thanks very much.
Elder statesman Eastwood. I think you've got that one down. So,
it's going on the list.
So apart from, I just want to give a quick mention to the blender, which makes an appearance, because when Chunk is captured by the Fratellis, he's sort of half tortured with the threat of a blender. And we've now done so many films on this podcast where blenders are a thing that I can't stop thinking of them as sort of like, what's the equivalent of now? Like everyone's got one. You want to show it off in your film a little bit.
Well, it'd be something like a Nutribullet, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Check out my Nutribullet.
Yeah. But if it's all right with everyone, we're on the quest. We're finding the treasure. Da-da-da-da-da. We're going through the tunnels. And then I would like to talk about the wishing well scene, if that's all right with everyone.
Yeah, why? I'm interested. You seem to have taken umbrage, particularly with this wishing well scene.
I have taken umbrage with it. And then I was a bit devastated to find out if it's true that it was a Steven Spielberg directed scene, because I hate the dialogue and I hate the where it comes in the film and the structured opportunity that is missed in this wishing well scene. So the dialogue, if for a kid's film, is especially mawkish, which is, so they're in a wishing well and there's all these coins. Andy says, I always used to believe if you threw your money in, you got your wish. It's like, of course you fucking did, you idiot. It's a wishing well. What were you supposed to think? And then at that point, Mouth says, it has this weird breakdown where he's like, I'm not having this. I'm taking my money back. I used to think you got your wish as well, but you don't. And it's not cool. And it's like, what? Where has this come from? Like, all of a sudden, you're having this meltdown that you didn't get your wish. And the problem, that's my two problems with the scene. But the biggest problem for me is, here is a chance to create a low point for Mikey later on, because this is what serves as the low point. And it's not a low point.
Oh.
It's rubbish. So he's like, come on, guys, this is our time. If they find a potential escape to go up the well, and he's like, no, guys, this is down here. He literally says down here, because they're down there, it's our time, which doesn't mean anything, but nonetheless. So then they follow their friend. Now, what should have happened is he lies about the exit. We can't, it doesn't go up. Even though he sees Andy's boyfriend shouting down, no, we can't get out. Let's carry on. Then stuff goes wrong further on in the tunnels and they're trapped and he believes it's his fault, because it is his fault. That's a low point, not just going, hey guys, it's our time. Do you think?
Well, I think you've added Steven Spielberg to the list of people you can write better than.
Not my words, but thank you.
I mean, I'm still wondering what three 17-year-old lads were doing on like
hanging
a Friday
around a
night.
Wishing well.
Yeah, they're just standing around a wishing well, hanging out.
Yeah. Talking about third base or whatever.
I was quite intrigued by Troy, who's the bully of the group. And
he's a pervert as well.
He's a screenwriter now. He wrote the Cher Christina Aguilera movie Burlesque.
Wow. Brilliant.
Did he really?
Yeah. That's brilliant.
That is right.
It's not a bad film. Not a bad film. Interesting. Burlesque. Is that the... Yeah, Burlesque is the one which... The big twist in it is it's about... Isn't it about... It's a burlesque movie that's simultaneously about property development. I'm pretty sure the twist in it is that... You can, like, property exists at certain levels and you can own the ground floor of something, but not the first floor of something. I swear to God, that is the twist in a movie called Burlesque.
Bloody hell. We should have done a podcast about property development in movies.
It sort of goes from, like, sexy burlesque to... So, these are the rules of property development in Los Angeles currently.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes. I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly. Seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
I didn't mind the wishing well scene. Now that you've pointed it out, I'm not quite sure what Corey Feldman's on about. You're like, what wish did you make?
Yeah.
Did I miss something? Was there a wish that we should know about? Mm. Is it like, it's not even made clear whether it was that the town isn't going to get destroyed to make a golf course. It's like just this weird thing. It's almost like he's like, it's a bit more like his character from Stand By Me. It's almost like a crossover.
Yeah, it just comes out of nowhere, and I don't think it's resolved, and he's really upset. He's doing his best child acting, and it's kind of being kind, that's kind of wasted, but also being awful. It's like, we don't need to see that.
Agree, Victoria. Yeah.
Okay, great, great.
Yeah, I've got, carry on.
Okay, so after this, we're then back in the tunnels, and Chunk and Sloth break free from having been imprisoned by the Fratellis. And so the point being, we're all in the tunnels. We're all in the tunnels at different points. We've got the kids, we've got the Fratellis, we've got Chunk and Sloth sort of in order progressing towards the treasure. And at this point, I was getting slightly annoyed because it reminded me so much of Indiana Jones that the clues that the kids were solving weren't harder. Like, I wanted something to do along with them rather than just watch them read out directions. But then you get piano made of bones, and I really like that bit. I think that's a brilliant bit. It's a clue to solve.
Do you know how brilliant it is? It's brilliant enough for Steven Spielberg to rip it off for The Last Crusade.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, the floor's collapsing if you don't play the right notes, and the floor collapses if you don't spell Jehovah. But remember, in Latin, Jehovah is spelt with an I.
What a treat. Oh, let's do that film instead. Anyway, but I do like the Bones piano. It's just fun, isn't it? It's a good clue. So I was happy by this point that it seemed to be looking a bit more like Indiana Jones.
Yeah, also, because it looks terrifying, that thing. It's like, it's still got dried bits of flesh hanging off it. It's like, makes these horrible sort of sounds. Yeah, it's a nice thing. And there's not more of that. That's the problem. Yeah. It's like, if you had two more puzzles to solve, it would have felt like there was a challenge. As it is, they walk through a cave, play an organ and come to a pirate ship, and that's your lot.
Yeah, because in Indiana Jones, the Jehovah, the J mistake, he gets one mistake, doesn't he? Because it crumbles and he hops off it. Is that right? Yeah. But in this, you get like six chances to fuck it up, which doesn't
and
make
also,
any sense.
That's one of three puzzles, because before that, it's a penitent man, a penitent man, a penitent man kneels before God, and there's all those blades that come out of the wall, and then there's the bridge that he has to throw the gravel over. I mean, simple stuff that could have been in the Goonies.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But then, like you say, once the Bones piano thing is done and dusted, pun, we basically get to the pirate ship, which obviously is a brilliant moment because, as you've said, it was hidden from the kids until the day of shooting. And so their reaction to it is as it would be if you were a child and you saw a fucking brilliant pirate ship.
Yeah, there's a couple of weird moments on the commentary that got them all together with Richard Donner. One of them is a little bit earlier, Sean Astin, which he's denied since, but having watched it, because it's a visual commentary as well as an audio one, he just seems to get so annoyed with Corey Feldman interrupting him that he just gets up and leaves.
Who does?
Sean Astin, who plays Mikey.
Does he?
Yeah.
Wait, he walks off the ship?
Yep, he walks off the commentary. Wait. He's had enough of speaking about this movie.
So at what period? Wait, set a time frame. So where was it? When's the commentary? When was it done?
When the DVD came out, the special edition DVD. So quite a long time ago.
So years later.
Now. Yeah,
like
yeah.
Post Lord of the Rings or pre Lord of the Rings?
Oh, post Lord of the Rings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he's trying to tell a story about Cyndi Lauper, and he keeps getting interrupted, and then he just leaves.
Oh my god! And did you watch the Cyndi Lauper video? Sorry, carry on about the commentary first, and then we'll talk about Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah, I love the Cyndi Lauper video. I love it.
I watched all 12 and a half minutes of it. It's in two parts. It's nuts, that video. It's got like Rowdy Roddy Piper in it and other, like Andre the Giant's in it, and the Bangles are in it before anyone knew who the Bangles were. And it's just really odd. Steven Spielberg's in it, and it just goes on and on. It's like, do you know what it's like? It's like the Cannonball Run of music videos. It's just loads of famous faces messing about. But it's quite good.
And the weird thing is, in the movie, they're watching a music video on the telly about themselves that features themselves.
Yes.
And it's a music video that wasn't shot until after the film was made and spliced into that scene. So that's all.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's all a bit wonky. But what I was... Sorry, go on.
She did. Cyndi Lauper was the musical director of the soundtrack for the film. But that only carries so much weight because she wrote the song, the title song, Good Enough. And she was like, so the song's called Good Enough. And Warner Brothers went, no, it's not. She went, no, it is. Here it is. It's called Good Enough. And they went, nah, it's called The Goonies Are Good Enough.
Fair enough.
And so that's what it's called. And she didn't play it for years. Apparently she hated it at the time and has only recently, years later, warmed up to it. Yep, that's it. That's enough Lauper.
Yeah, but on that commentary, Corey Feldman denies this story that none of them saw the pirate ship in advance.
Oh, really?
He says that they all snuck in and took a look at it. And he actually won't shut up about it. And it quite upsets Richard Donner because he'd lived with this thinking that he'd done this cool thing.
Oh, that's awful.
But then what the nice thing is, the other kids all deny what Corey's claiming, saying, no, we didn't see it. We didn't see it. And Corey's like, yeah, you were with me. And then he starts saying, oh, Sean was with me. Sean's left. Sean saw it with me. And everyone's like, yeah, shut up, Corey.
Oh, so, oh man. Made me feel really sad. Just because, like, as a dad, he tried to do something nice for his kids, and then one kid wrecked it, but they're all pretending, no, Dad, no, we didn't. It's still good. You're still a good dad.
It's mouth living up to his name.
Awful. And then there's a moment on the pirate ship, which I hoped one of you might be able to explain to me, because I've seen this film a few times, and I still don't get it. Sean Astin has a connection that he tries to... like make you as a viewer really feel between himself and One-Eyed Willie. So he finds One-Eyed Willie and he finds a treasure and he's sort of saying thank you to him. And he's kind of saying, oh, me and you are sort of the same. Like we're connected through the years. These are not actual dialogue, I should say. But I didn't get it. Like what is the connection between him and this dead pirate beyond the fact that he had his map? He's trying to infer a similar character. And I just don't get it. I don't see it.
At the start, doesn't his character have a glass eye?
What?
It doesn't. Isn't there a bit about Mikey having a glass eye, so he relates to the one-eyed thing, and then obviously he takes off the eye patch, and he's like, "Oh, okay, we're not quite the same then."
Is that really it? I feel silly now.
I've never noticed that, Alex.
I'm pretty sure that's definitely it. I think
there's many problems with this setup, but if I could see your lying face, then I would know where I was. I've listened back to a few of these and I sound like such a fucking idiot because I haven't got a clue, like, what's going on?
But he says you were the first Goonie. I think he's trying to imply that sort of the adventures that he went on, One-Eyed Willie, the same as the adventures that Mikey and his friends go on. And actually, something I hadn't really picked up on before this viewing is them talking about the fact that when their parents were their age, they went looking for One-Eyed Willie's treasure.
Oh, yeah, that's
sweet. It's almost something that's been passed down from generation to generation. And I've always thought, you know, because there's been, you know, they've always talked about doing a sequel to this. It would be fun to see a prequel with his parents going on the adventure.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be better, yeah.
Prior to them.
Yeah.
I do. The One-Eyed Willie moment, in fact, possibly the moment from this entire movie that I definitely remembered and was a standout moment is the moment he lifts up the eye patch, because when you think one-eyed Willy, you don't think that he actually had no eye socket. He didn't just lose an eye. He had no eye socket. The bone. It was just bone where the eye socket should be. I thought that was quite good. I remember that being a bit of a shock when I was like 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah, I agree. And then the Fratellis turn up and there is a bit of a walk the plank. Well, not a bit. There's a walk the plank moment, which we should talk about because of a very well-known deleted scene. Because my problem with this in the film is that it doesn't really matter about being pushed into the water, because the water looks lovely and looks like it would be fun to go for a swim. And there's nothing yep. dangerous in the water, or is there? So I'm passing you the right. baton there. Talk about it.
Chris, do you want to go?
Yeah, well, there are two big deleted scenes from this film, and one of them you can completely understand why you can't understand why they deleted it, but with this one you can. The first one is early on. They go to the grocery store. Mikey finds that the map, the treasure map, maps up to their local map, and it's when stuff kicks off with Troy and Brand basically having a fight there, which sets up why Troy then does that thing with the car and the bike to Brand in the next scene. Okay. So that kind of helps make the film more sense. But yeah, it's this octopus scene. So Data obviously says that they saw a giant octopus in the
Which is weird
of the movie.
That they left that in. Like, I can't believe they didn't. Like, it's so odd that he still says it and there is no octopus in the movie. It's like, wow, that kid's a liar.
But the scene in question is, you know, it's an absolute disaster. They're in the water and Steph thinks Mouth is touching her, but we can see it's really an octopus under the water, or not an octopus. It's, what is it? It's just a lump of rubber.
I think I've heard it called by different people, a squid or an octopus. I think it's got the eyes of a squid, but I think it's tentacle. I honestly don't know. I think it's more of a squid, to be honest.
Oh, does Data call it a squid then?
No, he calls it an octopus.
I'm going to call it an octopus. Right. I'm going to keep calling it an octopus then. So this giant octopus is attacking them. And then to fight it off, Data puts a cassette in a cassette player and puts it in the octopus's mouth. And it either scares the octopus off or the octopus dances off. And it's a song called Eight Arms to Hold You by the Goon Squad. It's a song that was actually made for this movie and released in America and charted.
Please tell me, at what point does this scene get bad that you think it should have been cut? Because this is awesome right now. The octopus dances off to a song about eight arms. This is brilliant.
Have you watched it, Alex?
I never got as far as the bit with the Walkman. I saw the bit where the tentacles are under the water and Mouth's like, hey, it's not me. But I didn't know there was the bit with the cassette player. Brilliant. And very Data as well, because he's got all kinds of inventions, hasn't he? So that's
it's embarrassing. And I believe that that it's kind of like, you know, the Mandela effect, this thing that people think things from their childhood happened that didn't happen or didn't happen that did. So that's one of these where in America, I believe that when it was broadcast on the TV, because there's so much rude stuff and swearing, they cut out a lot of stuff and added in stuff. And so the octopus sequence was in some versions of this film that people watched as a child. And so when they were grown up discussing the film with friends, some people had seen this octopus scene and other people thought they were just completely making it up.
There is another scene that apparently was cut as well. You know the bit where Sloth and Chunker reach the water pipes that all the Goonies have walked past and Sloth pushes them up and goes, uh-oh, and you hear a car crash and other sound effects from above. Well, apparently, when he did that, when he pushed them up, it was meant to be the zoo. The pipes at the zoo somehow let out a couple of gorillas, which started running riot around the town. And they steal Troy's Ford Mustang convertible and drive, the gorillas drive around the town, getting up to mischief in convenience stores and petrol stations. And they were two guys in gorilla suits that were the gorilla suits that were used for the movie Greystoke. Rick Baker designed these gorilla suits. Steven Spielberg shot this footage himself. He was the director of this footage. And it didn't initially fit. And since then, they've lost the footage. So the thing is, when you think of Steven Spielberg and you go, oh, Steven Spielberg, there's some lost footage. Of all the possible lost footage that footage could be, you don't think it's a couple of guys fucking around in gorilla costumes.
Very Jumanji. When I watched, there's an unauthorized documentary about the Goonies online with a lot of the main people interviewed, and they talk about that, but they say that was a storyboard that was never shot. There's a series of storyboards they've got. That in the storyboards, it was an Almond Joy bar, not a Baby Ruth bar that Sloth eats. And there was a scene with leeches as well, where they all get covered in leeches at the wishing well. And Data uses his car battery he's been carrying around.
Battery?
Yeah.
And he uses that. They're so heavy.
Uses that to electrocute the leeches. But I guess the leeches ended up in Stand By Me, and the monkeys in the cars ended up in Jumanji. So.
Yeah.
Well, there's, you know, I mean, the Stand By Me thing, that whole story that Chunk tells to the Fratellis, where he's like, this one time I threw this vomit over the side of the balcony in a cinema and it made everyone else vomit. It was the worst thing I ever did. That is the Lardass story from Stand By Me.
Yeah.
Completely. And the actual short story that Stephen King wrote, the body that Stand By Me is based on, had been released at that point. So I honestly think it was a genuine steal. They were like, borrowing that's great.
Agreed.
Yeah. And then after that, it's a sort of race to the end. So Chunk or Superman, and with his friends, Superman, not Sloth, they rescue the kids. I can't remember what happens. They sort of struggle out of this gap and then they're running down the beach and all their parents are there because obviously they should have been reported missing by now, even if it's the 80s. But then these property developed golf men turn up. Oh, also a nice touch, but not nice, but 80s touch. Sean Astin's asthma appears to be a matter of willpower because it's the 80s. So even though he's got chronic asthma, he's like, who needs it? And chucks his inhaler in the sea as if to say, I'm all grown up now. I've been on this adventure and I no longer have asthma, which is ridiculous. And then the corporate baddie is defeated because Rosalita finds some of the gems that have made it back and it's enough to make a contract invalid or something. The reason I was disappointed by this ending a little bit is because I'd misremembered the ending. And do you want to know what my ending is? I don't know if it's better. Yep. In my ending, which is what I actually thought, this happens to be quite a lot, but this is what I really thought was going to happen. When One-Eyed Willy's ship, which I can't remember what it's called, it manages to sail out of the cave where it's been trapped for hundreds of years. I thought that caused a tremor of such significance that the town basically fell into the sea and therefore a golf course was no longer viable because of the coastal erosion.
How is that a victory for them? How is that a victory?
It's not, but I just thought that's how it ended. And I was like, oh, here comes the bit where it all falls in the sea. And that didn't happen. So that's a shame.
Originally, that whole ending was shot at the house, though. And they did it all at the house. And then they reshot it on the beach where they'd just come out of the cave because they just went, yeah, we want the pirate ship sailing off in the background. So they had to reshoot it there so they could have that bloody pirate ship in it. But I prefer your ending.
Thanks.
Vicky, I'm surprised at how little mention of Sloth.
I don't know what to say really because I feel a bit uncomfortable about it, about what happens to him and the way he's dealt with as a character and the way his family treat him. So I suppose what I've done is just sidestep it, which is a bit lazy, it's very lazy actually. I just feel nervous about it. I don't like the fact that he's chained up, obviously. I don't like the way that his mum talks to him. I don't know how to approach it, but
That suggestion at the end that she has caused whatever ailment he has mentally by dropping him on his head multiple times when he was a baby is properly horrifying to drop that in at the end of the film.
Yeah, it's not funny. So I didn't. Yeah,
it also feels. I can't tell. The way it's sort of delivered, it feels like it's just improv in the moment. I'd be interested to know, I don't know, if that was in the original script as a sort of reveal or whether they were just sort of messing about on set and that was come up with and someone went, let's leave it in. It's the 80s.
Yeah, it feels like it's very naturally delivered and it feels really quick. And
yeah.
She would obviously be capable of, she was a good actor. So yeah, it's this, it seems conceivable.
They set it up. Just... They set it up though, the fact that how frightened they all are of this mama. All three of these pretty big blokes are absolutely terrified of this woman. It's interesting. There's some video online of watching the actor who plays Chunk having the makeup applied to him. And it's amazing makeup with the eyes and the ears moving independent. He was an American football player who won Super Bowl for the Raiders, a guy called John Matuszak, who was an absolute giant. And I had fun watching interviews with him. He was, talk about a playboy in real life. Unfortunately, sort of the drugs and the booze and the partying got him, and he died not long after this. But yeah, he lived several lives in his sort of 40-odd years on the planet. And I think he really does imbue Sloth with I don't know, a vulnerability and a heart and a soul. And it's a very memorable character.
Yeah, fair enough. Because it's not scary. And I know the reveal is that he's, you know, when you see him at first, he's not lit from the front. It's just in shadow and he's roaring and the kids are scared when they see or hear him. But then when we see or hear him, he's quite sweet, so it does work.
It
on that
scared
level.
7-year-old me though, and when I rewatched it, even though I knew that he's ultimately a good person, and saves the day at the end, I would still be very frightened in those first couple of scenes. The way they shoot him, like we're watching a horror film.
Yeah.
Yeah, it all happens when they get to the Fratelli's hideout. I mean, there's the sloth moment, and then there's that whole bit which you sort of go, "This is." Like you sort of go, in another movie, this is horror, pure horror, where Chunk gets locked in a refrigerator with a dead body hanging up on a meat hook. You're like, wow, this is, I love it for that, though. That's what I love about it. I love the fact, I think you said it earlier, Chris, like, you know, these young filmmakers who were just like, wow, let's just throw everything at this and it will get made. It will hit cinema screens. People will watch this.
Yeah, and upset my mum and dad.
I asked my dad. They're obsessed about the mess, I think. Like, because they don't want to encourage you before they know it. You're fucking throwing your dinner at the windows or whatever. You can't have it.
I did tell my dad that we were doing this on the show and asked him his memories of that day. And he said, I remember not liking the film, but liking spending the day out in London with you two.
Oh, your dad's so nice. Come on, Chris. Don't do that to me. Oh, wow. That's lovely.
Classic
lovely.
Ted
Goonies
Philly.
Never say die.
So unless anyone's got more to add, I think we could move on to the bits.
Let's do it.
Go for it.
So, Chris, what was your best scene?
It's funny, Alex just mentioned it. The scene when they ask Chunk to tell them everything. And he tells them everything. I think it's a really funny scene. It's really well written. It's really well delivered. That scene in Stand By Me, I hate because they show you the vomiting. But him describing the puke in the movie theaters are really effective. And the thing that made me sad is Jeff Cohen talking about some of it was true that he was saying, like he did get sent to fat camp in real life.
No.
He just said that he didn't run away. He sort of quite enjoyed it and got on with it there. But yeah, I think that's a really effective scene and it still makes me funny. And as Alex says, that Josh Gad reunion show, he does actually reenact it, him and Robert Darby, and it's very funny.
It is, isn't it? It's a really good moment on that show.
Alex, what's your best scene?
My best scene is... And I feel like I've done this twice on recent shows, and this is really sort of out of my comfort zone in terms of what I mentioned. But the score at the start, I don't remember the Goonies score whatsoever. And when it comes in at the start, what's his name? David, I wrote it down somewhere because I'm not used to talking about the score. Anyway, Mr. Composer, he's put together a right great score. And the car chase through the city where you're introduced to each of the Goonies like individually as they watch the car chase going by. And then I should say at this point, as I go on about the car chase, I love nothing more than a car chase. So when it looks like a scene from Smokey and the Bandit 2 at the end, where the truck joins another shitload of trucks on a beach and they're all racing together, I was like, oh, I wish the whole movie was like this. But I love the start of the movie, and it is largely to do with the score. It really set up like this, like the feel of what was to come, and nothing quite equaled it, but I loved it. So yeah, the opening for me.
Lovely. I would just say it's obvious, but it's the reveal of the pirate ship, because I love a theme park and I love a pirate ship galleon swing ride thing, and I love like fake pirate stuff. And so even as a grown up watching that film, I was still super jealous of those children being able to play on a pirate ship like that. I think that's good to make me feel like that, as jaded and bitter and closed off as I am. So I think
I don't want to break your heart, Victoria, but apparently they couldn't find anyone to take the pirate ship afterwards. No one wanted to use it for any of the movies. It had nowhere to go, so it was broken up, Victoria.
No.
It was destroyed. The set was turned to ash in seconds.
Oh my God, don't say that. I would have had it. We could have put it in my massive garden. No, I don't have. That would have been fine. MVW, please, Chris.
I'm nearly giving this to Sloth's Wiggling Ear. I'm a big fan of that. But I'm going to go for Anne Ramsey as Mama Fratelli. Because she brings real horror and terror to this film. I don't like it at the end when the Fratellis seem silly and slapstick. I think it's much more effective in this film when they seem very capable and very frightening people. And I just think it's amazing for her that she had this moment. She was sort of a jobbing TV actor. She was vaguely recognisable, but she wasn't really famous. And this really put her on the map. The reason she's talking with some difficulty, or it's kind of a bit unclear at times, is because she'd recently had some of her jaw and tongue removed because of cancer the year before. And just 3 years later, she actually died of cancer. But in this small period of time between The Goonies and Throw Mama from the Train, she became this huge star. And she really enjoyed it by all accounts. And I just think it's a really great performance and a real sort of surprise when you go into this film that she's one of the things that really sticks in your head.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
There's that great moment where she wants Robert Darby to go through the fireplace. And she's like, go through the fireplace. And he goes, oh, Mama, I don't want to go first. And she just points the gun at him. He goes, well, when you put it like that, of course. It's really well delivered. All right, my MVW is the Sloth and Chunk. I'm pleased we talked about Sloth at the end because it's the Sloth and Chunk double act. I think if you took Chunk out of the movie, it'd be missing something, because I think he's great. But I think both of them together is fantastic. I mean, you know, the whole Sloth loves Chunk line, and that being possibly the most affecting line in the movie, and their friendship, and I love it all. I do feel for Chunk's parents at the very end when Chunk just really puts them on the spot, because he says to Sloth in front of them, you're gonna come and live with me now.
Yeah.
And they're sort of like, okay, that's a conversation, Mr. Sloth. We know nothing about you, but really, Chunk, really, you really fucked us this time, didn't you?
Yes, exactly. I agree. My most valuable whatever is Josh Brolin as Brand. He's just better than everybody else. And without him sort of holding that group of kids, well, without him and without Martha Plimpton, actually, it might be unwatchable. Sorry. So there we go.
Wow.
I know. And if you could change anything, Chris, what would you change?
Well, I would get rid of Josh Brolin's Brand. I think he's the worst thing in...
You always do that.
No, I don't. But I did actually think he wasn't that good in this, but that's not my change. I just wanted to say that because I'm not in agreement with you, Vicky. I want to state that for the record. I think the film really fizzles out. I think you should be building up to the best action sequence in the movie for that finale. And... I mean, the excitement is Chunk swinging, Sloth swinging down and kicking them. Like, I just think it really fizzles out when it should build to a real crescendo. So I think sort that ending out.
Yeah.
I'm 100% with Chris. But I mean, for me, it's like, So you've written this giant octopus in. There is no way that that isn't going to be like a bit of a like, whoa, we got a giant octopus moment. And then someone's gone, hey, Chris Columbus, yo, we've taken the giant octopus out. It really wasn't working. So obviously need to put something in its place. And he's like, nah. Not gonna. Sounds like a lot of work. I've moved on. Emotionally, I'm not there anymore. They're like, yeah, but we've lost the octopus. Big action set piece. It's just not there. He's like, yeah, I know. You just told me,
Alex.
Like,
you really
cool.
You really need to watch that deleted scene. It's not a big action sequence. It's a.
Is it not?
It's a joke. It's played for a joke rather than an action beat.
I just think, like Vicky said, you got this water there. You've got a guy on set who famously can make things under the water scary.
Oh, God.
I just really think there are options there. Yeah. The whole pirate ship thing, the whole end of the movie, I think you're right, it fizzles out because there isn't a big, ba-ba-ba, look at that, it's a shark flying through the air.
What if they'd had to all run from coastal erosion? Yeah?
Bring Roland Emmerich to direct the last 10 minutes. Yeah.
There you go. You can have that.
Or a big boulder. Or a big freaking boulder.
A big boulder. Yeah, why not? There is a scene where Data nearly gets run over by a boulder, isn't there? I'm sure there is another Indiana. Anyway,
there are those big falling weights, yes! Like giant rock weights,
like
come
big
down.
Rocks, yeah, that roll after him, kind of. My change would be to give Chunk the love story, such as it is, because Brand, there's no way that guy's a late starter, right? So he would blatantly already have a girlfriend of some sort. So it would counterbalance.
Get a room, Vicky. Get a room. Bloody
sorry, I know. I don't even know how old he's supposed to be.
Kid.
He's a child. But I think it would counterbalance all the fat shaming, because we'll talk about this as well when we talk about Monster Squad. But the way that these characters, the characterization that you give to the kids that you're like, oh, you're a big kid, is they're funny and humorous, but there's no suggestion that they could be the sort of main guy with the love affair or anything like that. So give Chunk the love story, and then years later, it takes the pain out of all the fat shaming nonsense.
All right, then. I think we're done on the Goonies. Before we crack into the Monster Squad on Thursday, would anyone like a mid-episodes quiz?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, the quiz is called The Gang Bang.
I really like it.
Because both films deal with gangs. So I'm going to list 7 gangs. I just would like to know if these gangs are real gangs from movies or they are gangs that I've just made up for shits and giggles. Okay. The Rock Riders. Your first gang is the Rock Riders.
I'm going to go true.
Made up.
The Rock Riders is... true. Ooh. It's the motorcycle gang in Mad Max Fury Road. Okay, your next gang. Are they real or did I make them up? The Young Bastards.
They're real.
I'm going to say made up.
I made them up. I just made them up. So Chris has got 2. Vicky, I'd like you to write into your next script a character, a gang called the Young Bastards.
Done.
Your next gang, the Electric Eliminators.
Made up.
True.
It is... true. Chris, do you know where they're from, though?
Rollerball?
It's not Rollerball. It's the Warriors. They are one of the gangs in the Warriors. Okay, Chris is on 3. Vicky's on 0. We have 4 gangs left. So, Vicky, it's time to make that comeback we've been talking about. Your next gang is the Dead Rabbits. The Dead Rabbits.
True.
I think it's made up.
Vicky thinks it's made up. Chris thinks it's true. It is true.
For fuck's sake.
Chris, do you know what they're from?
No, but it rings a bell.
It's from Gangs of New York.
Oh, of course.
Is
Brendan,
it?
Of course. Yeah, Liam Neeson's gang is the Dead Rabbits. All right, 3 to go. New gang. Made up or real? The Large Owls.
Made up.
I'm going to go true.
I made it up. Oh, I made it up, Victoria. It's 4-1. You can't win, but we've only got two to go. This could be a mini comeback. Penultimate gang, the showering men.
made up.
It's made up. It is made up. And finally, the Foot Clan.
True.
Oh, true.
Is true. It's from
Turtles.
Yes, exactly. So the final scores. Christopher has 6. Victoria has 3. Chris, you know more about gangs than Victoria.
Do you want to be in my gang, my gang, my gang?
Right. Dude, probably cut that.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Or don't pay in the royalties.
Right then, lovely stuff. That is Goonies covered. So our competitor, the challenger this week, is the Monster Squad. We'll be back on Thursday to go through that slice of 80s nostalgia. Join us then. In the meantime,
can I do a clue?
Yes.
Oh, you want to do a clue?
Yeah.
I think you do it on purpose. You wait for me to hit my really big stride in the outro, and then you go, actually, just as you're about to say, get in touch, you have a little clue from Chris. Go on.
All right. Well, introduce it, Alex.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris's clue.
For next week's show, I am going to give you guys a clue for the two movies. And the clue I'm giving is the show must go on.
Okay.
I like it. Thanks. The clue then is the show must go on for next week's clash. And in the meantime, we're going now. This is the second goodbye. It's not going to be quite the same as the first. Do get in touch on Twitter at ClashPod. Hit us up on email at show@clashpod.com. And do rate and review us, Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back to do the Monster Squad on Thursday. Bye-bye.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.